Scripture reading is from Job 32, 1 through 14. Then these three men ceased answering Job, because he was righteous in his own eyes. But the anger of Elihu, the son of Barachel, the Buzite, of the family of Ram, burned. Against Job his anger burned because he justified himself before God. And his anger burned against his three friends because they had found no answer, and yet had condemned Job. Now Elihu had waited to speak to Job because they were years older than he. And when Elihu saw that there was no answer in the mouth of the three men, his anger burned. So Elihu, the son of Barachel, the Buzite, spoke out and said, "I am young in years, and you are old. Therefore I was shy and afraid to tell you what I think. I thought age should speak, and increased years should teach wisdom. But it is a spirit in man, and the breath of the Almighty gives them understanding. The abundant in years may not be wise, nor may elders understand justice. So I say, listen to me. I too will tell what I think. Behold, I waited for your words. I listened to your reasoning while you pondered what to say. I even paid close attention to you. Indeed, there was no one who refuted Job. No, not one of you who answered his words. Do not say we have found wisdom. God will rout him, not man. For he has not arranged his words against me, nor will I reply to him with your arguments."
What a profound passage. We're continuing this evening in our study of the book of Job. And I would invite your attention to that study as we review a little bit of the things that we've talked about to set the stage of the things that we want to discuss tonight. We noted in our closing remarks this morning that primarily our objective this evening is to examine the speech now of this younger man, Elihu. But we want to back up just a little bit and set the stage for the things that Elihu has to say. Now, in our last study, we did what I called an introduction of the book. What we typically do when we study a particular book of the Bible, we try to identify when it was written, who wrote it, where it was written from, and several of the things such as that. And what we come to was, don't know. Don't know when it was written. Don't know who the writer was. And don't know where it was written from, don't know the exact time frame that it's applicable to, as far as the writer is concerned. And someone may say, well, why are you studying such a book if you don't know anything about it? Well, that's a legitimate question. But what we do know about it is that Job lived. We know that because of the writing of the Old Testament prophet Ezekiel, and he cites Job as an example to illustrate the points there in chapter 14 and in verse 14. And James, the New Testament writer, offers the example of Job as an example of patience. And we know that the book is inspired because we have the Apostle Paul quoting from it. Much later, of course. Now, we noted that the time span for the supposed dating of the book of Job ranges about 1,000 years. And all kinds of different fellows have been suggested as the fellows who authored the book. We don't know with certainty, but we do know that it is a book that came from the mind of God. And it serves a valuable purpose to help us with the questions of life. Now we raise the question, who was Job? Well, we don't know much about that either. All we're told is where he was from. He was from the land of Uz. And somebody said, well, where's that? Don't know that either. Not with any great degree of certainty. But what we do know is in verse 1 of chapter 1, he's described as a perfect and upright man, one that feared God and turned away from evil. We also know that he was very wealthy. In verse 3, blessed by God, that this man was the greatest of all the children of the East. And then we also learned that he offered sacrifices. He rose up early in the morning and offered burnt offerings according to the number of them all, and that he did that continually. So he served in the priestly capacity for his family, and then later we see in the last chapter on behalf of his three friends. And we also must underscore verse 8 of chapter 1. There is none like him in all the earth. Not one like him. He's a perfect man, an upright man, one that feareth God and turned away from evil. Now, as we look at some of this background information in the first chapter, obvious question, verse 9, Satan asks, does Job fear God for naught? Will a man serve God for nothing? Now, that becomes the question of the discussion of the book for the most part, and we're going to see that the answer to that is yes. We're also going to note that God said to Satan, if you don't think he's serving me simply because it's right, then you take away everything that he has, but you can't touch him. And we know that Job lost everything that he had, all of his wealth, his herds, his flocks, even his own children. 10 children. He lost all of it in a moment of time. The statement that occurs over and over, while he yet spake, in came another servant and reported another calamity. And then the question is asked of Satan, can I get a hold of Job? He'll renounce you if I can get to him. Yes, you can smite Job's body, but you can't take his life. And we know then that Job was smitten with boils from the top of his head to the sole of his foot, and he was just in a miserable, miserable state. Now, some of the things we observed is that God allowed Satan to act within certain parameters. He couldn't do just anything he wanted to. He was able to use the instrumentality of men. He used the Chaldeans and the Sabaeans to take away some of the things that Job had. He even had control to some degree over the forces of nature as a great wind smote the house where his children were and smote his children. And we do know that he had control over disease as Job's body was smitten with boils from the top of his head to the sole of his foot. And all of this, we see that Job's wife became unfaithful to God, and Job could not rely upon her for the support that he needed during such an adverse or difficult time. And again, we have to reiterate that Job's wife, she's lost everything too. She's even lost her husband, his health, as far as that end of it is concerned. But she was not supportive of Job in all of his calamities. And then Job's friends made some of the most ridiculous arguments, but we want to note that the arguments that they made were made on the same premise as that which Job was reasoning that caused him such great perplexity. And that is, what evil have I done to cause all of these awful things to come upon me? Now, Job is claiming his innocence. Let us understand that Job does not say that he has never committed a sin. He does not claim that. But Job's problem is, I don't understand what I've done that is in proportion to all of this. Now, you see how he's reasoning. There must be something that I've done, something of great magnitude to cause me to lose everything in such a short amount of time and to suffer such calamity. In other words, what's happened to me must be punishment for something. But Job, in searching his own heart, could not find a single thing or group of things that he had done that would merit such punishment. And then Job's friends, Eliphaz, Zophar, and Bildad, they came along essentially reasoning from the same position. And they're going to tell him what he's done. Yes, Job, you've done something horrible in order that these calamities would come upon you. All right, Job's desire is, you tell me what it is. Well, they continue to tell him, and of course Zophar comes up with some things that he doesn't establish, doesn't offer specific illustrations of, but nonetheless he gives some very serious charges, and we've talked about that. We've noted that society as a whole, Job has become an outcast. I've never had boils, and therefore I've never had the need to treat a boil. Maybe some of you have. I understand they're just absolutely terrible in terms of pain, but I can't imagine what it would be like to have them from the top of your head to the sole of your foot, to the point that you would sit in the city's ash dump and put the ashes on the sores to make them hard so you could take a broken piece of pottery and rake out the infection. Now that's the state that Job is in. If you can just imagine the horror of that kind of affliction on top of everything else. And then to be told by somebody you love so well, just curse God and die. Can't do it. Just not an option. Now, in discussing some of these things with some of you last time, we were discussing the question of why is it that the righteous suffer, and can God trust man simply to serve him because it's right? And we were discussing that from the standpoint, well, maybe Job anticipated some reward that God was going to give him for his service. If not in this life, perhaps Job anticipated something on the other side, that he anticipated the glory of heaven and all of that. I want to call your attention to that. I have a place on the charts for it, but it's on my mind just now, so we'll look at it. In Job chapter 14, if you'll look at verse 1, Job said, "Man that is born of a woman is a few days and full of trouble. He cometh forth like a flower and is cut down." Now, as you drop down in that text in verse 14, he said, "If a man die, shall he live again? All the days of my warfare would I wait till my release should come." Now you read into that what you want, but I think what we see is that Job is questioning, not denying, but questioning just really what reward there is. And then why? Why all this suffering? Now the next question that I want to look at is, can a man trust God when his suffering is just inexpressible and incomprehensible in its intensity? He cannot explain it. He cannot understand it. Now all this against the backdrop of that question, will a man serve God for nothing? That is, just because it's the right thing to do. He anticipates absolutely nothing. Will a man serve God because it's right? Now that's where we are. Now that's the question. Now Eliphaz, we looked at his three speeches briefly in Job 4, Job 15, and in Job 22. And as you look at Job 22, in that account, finally Eliphaz comes up with some kind of accusations that he considers Job to be guilty of. In verse 4, he said, "Is it for thy fear of him that he reproveth thee, that he entereth with thee into judgment? Is not thy wickedness great? Neither is there any end to thine iniquities, for thou hast taken pledges of thy brother for naught, and stripped the naked of their clothing." Now here's what Eliphaz is telling Job, this is what you've done. Now does he offer any four instances, give any illustrations, or are these just blatant accusations? Well, the latter. He said, "Thou hast not given water to the weary to drink, and thou hast withholden bread from the hungry. But as for the mighty man had the earth, and the honorable man, he dwelt in it. Thou hast sent away widows empty. The arms of the fatherless have been broken. Therefore snares are round about thee, and sudden fear troubleth thee." Job, look at all these terrible things that you've done. All right, can you cite even one example when I did that? Well, no, he doesn't offer any illustrations of it. These are just general accusations of what Job has done. Now, when you look at Bildad, he made three speeches. And his speeches were of the same kind. "Job, you've done something, and if you'll just repent of what you've done, God will bless you." And then Zophar. Zophar takes the cake, if I may use that expression, as far as his accusations being so harsh and cruel. Zophar, in Job, the 11th chapter, makes this statement beginning in verse 6. He said, "And that thou would show thee secrets of," or that he would show thee secrets of wisdom, "for he is manifold in understanding. Know therefore that God exacteth of thee less than thine iniquity deserveth." Now, isn't that a friend? Job, you think you've got it bad? You don't have it near as bad as what you ought to after all the horrible things that you've done. All right, Zophar, what have I done? Well, he can't tell. But whatever it is, you deserve worse than what you've got. Now, that's comforting, isn't it? We're going to see some of this in Job's response or his answers to some of his friends in a later study. But Zophar does make a concession. He tells Job in chapter 20, he said, "The triumphing of the wicked is short, and the joy of the godless is but for a moment." What's he telling you? Job, you've done something really bad. And whatever it is that you've done, you deserve double. It's just that bad. But rest assured that the wicked suffering is not going to be all that long. One day it'll cease. Now that's comforting, isn't it? Just the kind of friend everybody wants. Now, why is this suffering so intense? This is what Job doesn't understand that establishes the background of the book. See, Job don't know about chapter 1 and chapter 2. He just endures the loss of all of this. And then immediately in chapter 3, he curses the day he was born. Wished he had never been born. Wished he had died in childbirth. And on he goes in the third chapter. But then when he gets to the sixth chapter, he blames God with being unmerciful to him, to put this hardship upon him when he's not done anything that is the equivalent of anything near this kind of suffering. And then in the ninth chapter of Job, notice in verse 20 and 21 beginning, he said, "Though I be righteous, mine own mouth shall condemn me. Though I be perfect, it shall prove me perverse. I am perfect, regard not myself. I despise my life. It is all one. Therefore I say, he destroyeth the perfect and the wicked. If the scourge slay suddenly, he will mock at the trial of the innocent. The earth is given unto the hand of the wicked. Covereth the faces of the judges thereof, if it be not he. Who then is it?" You see Job just shaking his head. "I don't understand. Such awful things, such misery. I despise my very existence. And if it's not God, I don't know who to blame." Now Job had that right, because he didn't know that Satan was behind all of this. And sometimes we blame God, and it's not God's fault. We raise the question, kind of like Job, "What did I ever do to deserve all this? Why me?" Well, we forget about there's another character at work who is to blame. And Job did not realize that. Now, Job begins to change a little bit in his attitude, at least, in the 13th through the 19th chapters. Now, we've not discussed that in some detail, and I really, at this point, I kind of want to pass over that. But what I do want to note is that Job's contention is, "I am righteous, but God is almighty. He's all wise, and he possesses all power. And somehow, some way, there's going to be an answer to my question." Now, my friend, what is his question? Why? Why am I suffering all these things? What have I done to bring all this upon me? And what Job, I'm not sure he ever realizes this, but the reality is, all suffering is not punitive. Job and his friends were wrong in their philosophy about suffering. All suffering is not punishment for something. It may be consequential. It may be the consequences of somebody having done something wrong. But that doesn't mean that it's punishment to you that you've done wrong. And we need to see the distinction between those things. I don't think Job ever did. But in this discussion between Job and his friends, there's two questions that seem to be answered. Man will and man does serve God because it's right. And secondly, man can trust God because God does not afflict man just simply to hurt him. God doesn't do that. Now there's more. We say, well, why don't the book just end there with this discussion between Job and these three friends? Well, I want you to note that Job has begun with a philosophy that needs to be answered. And Job's three friends, in their efforts to comfort him, they've suggested absolutely nothing different. Their philosophy has been the same. They've just carried it to the nth degree. And even Job himself, he has said some hard things about God that need to be corrected. They need to be responded to. Now that brings us to this portion of our study. The study of the things that Elihu has to say. Now we raise the question, well, who is Elihu? Well, we're introduced to him here in the 32nd chapter of this book. And it says, beginning in verse 1, as Noah read a few moments ago, that these three men, they ceased to answer Job because he was righteous in his own eyes. And Elihu begins to speak. And he feels that somehow he's got something to say that's different from what these friends have had to say. Now, I want to call your attention to two things. Well, basically two things. One is that Elihu feels compelled to answer Job's friends. But he also feels compelled to answer Job. Now that's interesting to me. Well, what is it that Elihu thinks that he has to say that hasn't already been said? Well, if you'll note, beginning in verse 6, it says, "And Elihu, the son of Barachel, the Buzite, answered and said, I am young, and ye are very old. Wherefore I held back and does not show you mine opinion." I didn't tell you what I thought, but I'm affixing to. In verse 7, I said, days should speak. In other words, I should yield to old age. It says, the multitude of years should teach wisdom. But there is a spirit in man, and the breath of the Almighty giveth him them understanding. It is not the great that are wise, nor the aged that understand justice. Now hold your finger right there. What Elihu has said is right. Generally, those who are older have gleaned some wisdom from the years. But it don't make them right just because they're old. Now, Elihu's got that part right. But then he said, verse 10, therefore I said, hearken unto me. I also will show mine opinion. You listen to me. Now I'm going to tell you what I think. Now, I find that interesting. In fact, I find that somewhat revealing because if you'll count, depending on the translation, you'll note that the terms I, Elihu refers to 19 times in this one chapter. And such terms as me and mine and equivalents such as that, he refers to 13 times. What does that tell you that he thinks about himself? Now we might say, well, Elihu was somewhat arrogant. And we might attribute that and say, well, he was arrogant because he was a young whipstart, upstart, that sort of fellow, whippersnapper kind of fellow. And so what he had to say, he just couldn't refrain himself. He thought he was a know-it-all. Well, now I know that sometimes young people are thought of in that way. And that ought not to be a generality. In 1 Timothy chapter 4 and in verse 12, the Apostle Paul told Timothy in his work as a young preacher, "Let no man despise thy youth." And you're familiar with that. He said, "But in everything, be thou an example to them that believe in word and manner of life and love and faith and in purity. Let no man despise you because you're young." Now let it be understood that though some might generally characterize young people as arrogant, that ought not be so. Not all young people are arrogant. And though some might discard what somebody says because, "Well, you're young, you don't understand." When I first started preaching, I had that told to me so many times. I thought, "You know, you're right. I am young, and there are many things that I have not experienced. But that does not change what God says about it." Now, that's just the fact of the matter. But sometimes what a young person has to say is discarded because they're young. Well, that ought not be so either. I've heard some mighty sharp things come out of some young mouths. And you're familiar with the expression, quote, "out of the mouth of babes." You see, it's not altogether simply a matter of age. Now, Elihu is young, and he yields to these older men, which I think is an attribute that's to be admired. But you know, Elihu thinks that he has something additional to say, something more than what's already been said. And he's going to approach this thing from an entirely different viewpoint. Look, if you will, in verse 4 of chapter 32. It says, "Now Elihu had waited to speak unto Job because they were elder than he. And when Elihu saw that there was no answer in the mouth of these three men, his wrath was kindled." Now what is it Elihu thinks he's got? He's got something different from what any of these guys have already said. He's got something to contribute. Now his reasoning is, "I'm going to reason with you differently from these other men." Now what he attempts to do is to vindicate God, to rebuke these other three men that have proven themselves to be less than friends to Job. And he's going to try to correct or refine Job's thinking about God. That's what Elihu attempts to do. And what he adds to the mix is that though what you're enduring may not necessarily be punishment for some wrong that you've done, it may be disciplinary, and we intend to define that just a little bit. That doesn't mean punishment for wrongdoing. Discipline is not always punishment for wrongdoing. Sometimes it can be instructive or corrective. Now Elihu adds that into the mix. But the speeches of Elihu, and what we want to see in the latter part of the 37th chapter, is he paves the way for the Lord to speak. Up until this time, the Lord has not addressed Job's perplexity. Now, I think that as we study in these chapters, we're going to see three very important contributions of this young man, Elihu. Now, I want to spend just a moment on this chart. Look at it carefully. He does point out some things that Job needs to rethink. Now, in Job chapter 33, in this portion of Elihu's speech, beginning in verse 8, Elihu said, "Surely thou hast spoken in my hearing. And I have heard the voice of thy word, saying, I am clean, without transgression, I am innocent, neither is there iniquity in me. Behold, he findeth occasion against me, he counteth me for his enemy. He putteth my feet in stocks, he maketh or marketh all my paths. Behold, I will answer thee in this, thou art not just, for God is greater than man." Now, question, had Job said that? Had Job said, "I am clean, without transgression, I am innocent"? Yes, he had said that. Had Job said that God counts me as his enemy? Yes, he had said that. Was that accurate? No, it was not. No, that was not accurate. Now, when Elihu says, I'm going to answer you, God is greater than man. Well, Job made no argument with that. That's true. But what I want you to note in this is Elihu is trying to point out some thinking on behalf of Job that isn't sound. And you'll also note, as you come to the next chapter, chapter 34, Elihu answered and said, Hear my words, ye wise men, and give ear unto me, ye that have knowledge. For the ear trieth words, as the palate tasteth food. Let us choose for us that which is right. Let us know among ourselves what is good. For Job hath said, I am righteous. Well, had Job said that? Yes, he'd said that. And God hath taken away my right. Had Job said that? Yes. He's claiming that God has somehow mistreated him. He said, notwithstanding my right, I am accounted a liar. My wound is incurable, though I am without transgression. Had Job indicated such? Yes, that's what he said. Now, should Job have said those things? No. Because in saying those things, he has indicted God. Now, as you drop down further in that text, I want you to note in chapter 34, in verse 34, turn the page, verse 34, there Elihu charges, Men of understanding will say unto me, Yea, every wise man that heareth me, Job speaketh without knowledge, and his words are without wisdom. Would that Job were tried unto the end because of his answering like wicked men. For he addeth rebellion into his sin. He clappeth his hands among us and multiplieth his words against God. Now, what has Elihu said? Elihu has said, Job, you said some hard things about God. You ought not to have said them. Well, that's true. He said that God is mighty. Well, that's true, and Job would not take issue with that. And he has said, Job, you don't understand. Well, that's the problem. Job acknowledges that he doesn't understand. But you see, Elihu is attempting to explain it to him, and he doesn't understand any more about it than Job does. Because he's unaware of chapter 1 and chapter 2, just like Job and these other three friends. He don't know that. Now, what Job is wanting to know is, what have I done to cause all of this calamity to come upon me? Now, the thing I find interesting is, Elihu, I've got all the answers that all your friends, they don't have. I can tell you, you listen to me, I know all about it. No, you don't. Because you see, when you're through, Elihu, you haven't identified a single solitary thing that Job did before these calamities came. Now that's Job's question. Why did all of this evil come? Now has Elihu answered that? No. He don't know a bit more about it than he did when he started. Now, what does that make Elihu? Well, you make of that what you will. Some say that makes Elihu just a scoundrel. Others say that makes him the most intelligent fellow that Job is reasoning with. I don't know. Somewhere in between, I suppose. But what we want to note is that he does reveal something else that's relatively important to this discussion that these other men have not suggested. First of all, in chapter 35... In verse 3, chapter 35, in verse 3, Elihu is responding, and he said, What thou sayest, what advantage will it be unto thee, and what profit shall I have? More, if I had sinned, I will answer thee, and thy companions with thee. Look unto the heavens and see, and behold the skies which are higher than thou. If thou hast sinned, what effect thou against him, or effectest thou against him? And if thy transgression be multiplied, what doest thou unto him? If thou be righteous, what givest thou him? Or what receiveth he of thy hand. Thy wickedness may hurt a man as thou art, and thy righteousness may profit a son of man. Now again, I simply want to make an allusion here to his ego. I've got the answer, and I'm going to tell you. Now here's how God answers all your questions. Go back a little bit to chapter 33, and let's pick it up there at verse 15. No, verse 13 through verse 15. He said, "Why dost thou strive against him?" Now this is Elihu's question. Why, Job, do you strive against God? "For that he giveth not account of any of his matters." Now hold your finger there. Elihu's got that right. God don't have to explain everything to you. And he certainly don't have to explain it to your satisfaction. You know, there are some things that you wonder about and you don't know, and you're not ever going to know because God has not made it known. And we often quote Deuteronomy 29:29 in reference to that. These are the secret things that belong to God, and they're not made known. So what do? You just acknowledge that those answers are not given and you move on. In verse 14, "For God speaketh once, yea, twice." Now we might word that and say, well, two or three times. He said, "Though man regardeth it not." Now how does God speak? Verse 15, "In a dream, in a vision of the night, when deep sleep falleth upon men and slumberings upon the bed. Then he openeth the ears of men, he sealeth their instruction, that he may withdraw man from his purpose and hide pride from man. He keepeth back his soul from the pit and his life from perishing by the sword." Now, did God ever speak to men in dreams? You don't have to let your mind wander very far till you can begin to think of instances where that was true. Perhaps one of the initial ones would be when God revealed to Joseph that folks would be bowing down to him like they later did in Genesis chapter 45. Other illustrations could be offered. But God doesn't speak that way today. The Hebrew writer tells us in Hebrews chapter 1, beginning in verse 1, that God, having in time past spoken to the prophets in divers portions and in divers manners, hath in the end of these days spoken unto us through His Son. So yes, God spoke unto the prophets in different ways. But now He speaks through His Son. One of those ways was through dreams. There were multiple other ways. But here is another that Elihu mentions in chapter 33, beginning in verse 19. It says, "He is chastened also with pain upon his bed, and with continual strife in his bones, so that his life abhorreth bread, and his soul dainty food. His flesh is consumed away, that it cannot be seen, and his bones that were not yet not seen stick out. Yea, his soul draweth near unto the pit, and his life to the destroyers." Now what is Elihu saying? That there are some things that man suffers that are intended to be effectual upon the thinking of man, that man can learn and profit and benefit from those experiences in life. Why do you suppose? Most difficult passage. James chapter 1, beginning in verse 2, where James said, "Count it all joy, my brethren, when you fall into manifold temptations, knowing that the proving of your faith worketh patience. Let patience have its perfect work, that ye may be perfect and entire, lacking in nothing." I'll admit, I struggled and struggled with that. When you're suffering, count it all joy when you fall into manifold trials. Well, what's the implication of that? There's something I can learn when things are not well. There is some benefit or profit, something that I could benefit for my sake or for the sake of teaching somebody else through suffering. The Apostle Peter in 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 12 said, "Beloved, think it not strange concerning the fiery trial among you, which cometh upon you to prove you, as though a strange thing happened unto you. But insomuch as ye are partakers of Christ's sufferings, rejoice at the revelation of His glory, that ye may rejoice with exceeding joy." And then he talks about what it means to be reproached for Christ's sake. Not suffering just for the sake of suffering, but for doing the things that are right. And then Hebrews chapter 12, how that we've used that so many times through the years to talk about the chastening of the Lord. No, the Lord doesn't bring bad things upon you just to watch you plunder and suffer. No. But sometimes we can learn from experiences of life things that we need to learn that might be profitable in our lives or profitable in the lives of somebody else. Now, Elihu continues in verse 23 of Job chapter 33 with another rather interesting point. He said, "If there be with him an angel, an interpreter, one among a thousand, to show unto man what is right for him, then God is gracious unto him, and saith, Deliver him from going down to the pit. I have found a ransom. His flesh shall be fresher than a child's, and he returneth to the days of his youth. He prayeth unto God, and he is favorable unto him, so that he seeth his face with joy, and restoreth unto man his righteousness." Now Elihu says that God communicates with a man through an angel. Well, now, I don't believe at this point that Elihu certainly doesn't consider himself as some kind of angelic being, a celestial being, but he does consider himself as a messenger from God, and therefore he considers his message to Job as one of relevance and great importance. I said he doesn't consider himself an angelic being in the sense of a celestial being. And I think you see that backing up in this same chapter to verse 6. He says, "Behold, I am toward God, even as thou art. I also am formed out of the clay. Behold, my terror shall not make thee afraid, neither shall my presence be heavy upon you." But what does he consider himself? He considers himself a messenger from God. And the thing that he has to say to Job is important. You need to listen to me, Job. I've got the answer. Now, again, the thing that we want to emphasize here is toward the latter end of Elihu's speech, he introduces Jehovah that asks some questions of Job that he simply cannot answer. Now, that's going to be for another study. But as we talk about Elihu, I said that Elihu leaves me with a mixed impression. I don't know that he's all that good, but when we come down to the final analysis of the thing, he winds up just exactly at the same place Job's friends do, although he said, "I've got a new and a different approach." No, he doesn't. He's added a little bit to the mix, but he essentially makes the same arguments that the friends of Job have made. You'll note that Job's concern in the 9th chapter is he wants to have an umpire, that is, a go-between he and God. Well, perhaps Elihu sees himself in that position, but how does he reason? Look in the 34th chapter of the book of Job, in verse 11. Well, let's start at verse 10. He said, "Therefore hearken unto me, ye men of understanding. Far be it from God that he should do wickedness, and from the Almighty that he should commit iniquity. For the work of a man will he render unto him, and cause every man to find according to his ways. Yea, of a surety, God will not do wickedly, neither will the Almighty pervert justice. Who gave him a charge over the earth, or who hath disposed the whole world? If he set his heart upon himself, if he gather unto himself his spirit in his breath, all flesh shall perish together, and man shall turn again unto the dust." Do you see what Elihu has said? That God will be just, he will render to man according to the things that he's done. Well, isn't that what Elihu and these others have all said? What's happened to you, Elihu, or Job? What's happened to you is the result of the things that you've been doing. Now look at verse 21 of this same chapter. He says, "For his eyes are set upon the ways of a man, and he seeth all his goings. There is no darkness nor thick gloom there where the workers of iniquity may hide themselves. For he needeth not further to consider a man that he should go before God in judgment. He breaketh in pieces mighty men in ways past finding out. He setteth others in their stead. Therefore he taketh knowledge of their works, and he overturneth them in the night. so that they are destroyed. He striketh them as wicked men in the sight or open sight of others, because they have turned aside from following him and would not have regard to any of his ways, so that they caused the cry of the poor to come unto him, and he hear the voice of the afflicted. Now we know, and the passage I could not think of last week is not in 2 Kings and it's not in 1 Kings, it's in Isaiah. In Isaiah chapter 10, beginning in verse 5, and we know that there God used the kingdom of Assyria as an instrument of His wrath, and later used the Chaldeans as an instrument of His wrath against the Assyrians. Well, here we are seeing people that are practicing evil and corrupt things, and God punishing them or destroying, raising up and taking down nations of people as a consequence of what they've done. But that's not the case here with Job. What's happened to Job may be a consequence, but not necessarily of sin that Job has committed. But that's just exactly what Elihu accuses him of. Do you see that? Just exactly. Now, what help is he more than the other friends of Job? He's right back where they were in the final analysis of things. In the 36th chapter of Job, beginning in verse 8, there the text says, If they be bound in fetters and be taken in cords of affliction, then he showeth them their work and their transgressions, that they have behaved themselves proudly. He openeth also their ear to instruction and commandeth that they return from iniquity. If they hearken and serve him, they shall spend their days in prosperity for the years and their years in pleasure. But if they hearken not, they shall perish by the sword and they shall die without knowledge. And you read the rest of that. That's the same speech that Job's friends have been making. You see, all your prosperity has been taken away because you've sinned. And God rewards the righteous with prosperity. And you see, that's just exactly the same reasoning that the other friends have offered, and it has been of no particular help. And we said that one of the things that Elihu does, and we'll close our study, and I apologize for going over, but I want to note these things, is that Elihu introduces God. In chapter 36, beginning in verse 24, we'll not read a lot of this, I simply want to make these observations. In verse 24, he said, "Remember that thou magnify his work, whereof men have sung, all men have looked thereon. Man beholdeth it afar. Behold, God is great, and we know him not. The number of his years is unsearchable, for he draweth up the drops of water, which distill in rain from his vapor, which the skies pour down and drops upon man abundantly. Yea, can any understand the spreadings of the clouds, the thunder, and so forth?" And so Elihu begins to present the majesty of God. As you drop down into this text, in the 37th chapter, the latter part of it, Elihu presents the scene of a great storm. You see that beginning in verse 9? "Out of the chamber of the south cometh the storm, and cold out of the north. By the breath of God, ice is given, and the breath of the waters is straightened." Now in verse 14, Elihu says, "Hearken unto this, O Job. Stand still and consider the wondrous works of God." Does that sound familiar to you, my friends? You remember when Moses brought the children of Israel up out of the land of Egypt, and the Egyptians were behind them, and the Red Sea is in front of them, and the wilderness on both sides. And they cried unto Moses, "Weren't there enough graves in all of Egypt to bury us? Why'd you bring us out here to die?" And Moses said, "Stand still and behold the salvation of the Lord." Now Elihu has got that right. Job, stand still and admire the majesty of God. In verse 21, "And now men shall not see the light which is bright in the skies, but the wind passeth and cleareth them. Out of the north cometh golden splendor. God hath upon him terrible majesty. Touching the Almighty, we cannot find him out. He is excellent in power and in justice and plenteous righteousness. He will not afflict. Men do therefore fear him. He regardeth not any that are wise of heart." Now, Elihu has got that right as he presents this image of the majesty and the greatness of God. Now, in the next chapter, God has something to say. And what we're going to note, and I passed out to a few of you who are song leaders, this song, "The Storm Passes By," I put it on the chart. You read the song, we're going to try to learn that. But be that as it may, I think the image that's presented here by Elihu sets a backdrop for the words of this song. When the storm passes by, God will be there. I won't ever fail you, and I won't ever forsake you. Now, that's comforting. Now, in those words, Elihu is right. And there's comfort, strength to be found in those words. And then God begins to speak. In our next study, we're going to examine that, but just to preface that with a little bit of excitement to you, in all of the things that God has to say to Job, he does not answer Job's question of why. I tell you what, folks, sometimes that question just don't get an answer. What do we have to do? We have to learn to be content. Because God won't fail us, and he won't ever forsake us. I believe that's encouraging. And that's encouraging, no doubt, to Job. He doesn't get all of his questions answered. Neither do we. God is not obliged to answer questions just because we're curious. You've listened kindly to our study. I hope it's helpful to you. Maybe I'm talking to somebody tonight who would like to obey the gospel and become a Christian. You can do that if you believe that he's the Christ, willing to turn from your sin. Confess your faith, would you be baptized tonight? Maybe you've obeyed the gospel, and because of the struggles of this life, you've somewhat turned your back toward God. Sometimes when I talk to those who are discouraged, sometimes when I'm discouraged myself, my thoughts are and my words are, that's just not an option. And so what we want to see is that whether Job anticipated a home with God in heaven forever and all of that or not, departing from God was just not an option with him. He was going to serve God because it's right. If we can help you tonight, make that known. While together we stand and while we sing.